Compassion for others. Thank you for listening to me. My Maria's musande, mundi tunga merire. My Maria musande, mundi tunga merire. Mundi tunga merire, mundi tunga merire, kuna mori baba. Mundi tunga merire, mundi tunga merire, kuna mori baba. Hey, oh. My Maria musande. Bienvenidos, Maria. Bienvenidos. Manlobo. Maria, no doubt you recognize her name. In Zimbabwe, Maria is the mother of the water spirits. She's also the female elephant. She's the full moon, and the stars are her children. African tradition in Africa or in the diaspora is what they call syncretic. There's the obvious brutal relationship with colonialism and slavery, etc. And to take the religion of the conqueror and make it indigenously African, you know. Maria, of course, was brought over by the Portuguese when they came to what is now Zimbabwe in the 1700s. And the tribal people sing that song to Maria, "My Mari Musande." She is the mediator, and she is, obviously, we all know, a profound spiritual, a spirit of loving kindness. Compassion for others moves on sympathetic joy and sympathetic sorrow. That's the Buddha's definition of compassion. Sympathetic joy is joy over another's joy. Sympathetic sorrow is sorrow over another's sorrow. Joy over another's joy. Well, I don't think I have told Michelle this yet. Maybe I did. I don't know. My 31-year-old daughter, the one I used to change the diapers of not long ago, is pregnant. So, joy over another's joy. Me and my ex-wife, Marcia, and her wife, Claudia, we're all kind of deciding what are we going to call ourselves? For whatever reason, Marcia wants to be Yaya, which is Greek, you know Greek, of course. Yaya. My wife is Jewish. She most certainly is not Greek. And her white Anglo-Saxon wife is what? I can't remember. It's Chinese. She's going to have a Chinese grandma name. I think I'm going to be Abuelito. My mother, Nicole's grandmother, is Abuelita. So I think I'm going to be Abuelito. So that's sympathetic joy. I can see it in your faces. The joy is in the room. That is quintessential to the practice of compassion. Quintessential. Nothing other than that. No big mystery. You know, no big mystery. Sympathetic sorrow. La-da-da. Where do I have my notes on sympathetic sorrow? Probably nowhere. Yes. Nicole pregnant. I swiftly recall when Nicole was in her mother's belly. My ex waxing full, her breast dripping colostrum. This, you understand, this is like I was just off the street. I mean, months off the street. sorrow of your sorrow. When I teach workshops in the craft of compassion, I say, what is the joy of your joy with which you meet another's joy? What is the sorrow of your sorrow with which you meet another's sorrow? And I have people collect these stories. They are like a medicine bundle, you know, because through our experience, we connect to another's story. They intersect one way or another. Our experience or some kin, you know. I remember working at UCLA Medical Center. Had a patient with leukemia. She's maybe 23 years old, which was my daughter's age then. She was on stem cell transplant, I think. And she was kind of knocked out on, como se dice, some med, I can't remember. Ativan was putting her asleep. And her father was at the bedside, and she had a little photograph of her acting in A Midsummer's Night Dream. And I said to the father, I said, my daughter's that age. My daughter's your daughter's age, and she is an actress. That was sufficient. That was, that's sympathetic sorrow. I didn't have to say anything else. He got it. My little brother Paul, poor baby. I used to experiment being his dad when I was 8 and 9 years old. he was psychotic, and he was out of his mind, and he wandered away in the forest outside of Santa Fe. And we didn't know whether he was dead or alive for 4 years. And I was, again, working at UCLA Medical Center. There was a secretary, Art, very fervent Pentecostal guy, whose brother was shot in a drive-by shooting. And Art was the only one who could connect with me about this. I came to work one day, and we hadn't found my brother then, yet. And he said, how are you doing? And I gave him the usual glib answer. I'm back at work. Oh, I'm doing fine. Things are cool. You know, whatever, you know. And then he said, no, really. And that was also sufficient. That is sympathetic sorrow. That is the essence of it. And between the joy over my daughter being pregnant or the sorrow that Art was able to connect to me through. That is the essential stuff of the teaching of compassion. The question is, how does one, we get obsessively preoccupied with our own experience and enclosed in it. But really, our experience is what connects us to others. One goes through it. Step three, radical empathy. Now, you must understand, this step three and four, there's a paradigm shift here. I was going to wear my ritual garb, which is a New Yorker cartoon t-shirt, where the doctor's looking at the patient and grave expression on his face, stethoscope draped around his neck, and he says, "I'm afraid you've had a paradigm shift." So, you know, this is the step one and two, self-compassion, compassion for others. We can conceive of that. We can frame it in the idea that I am the source of my compassion with a capital M, you know. When we start moving into radical empathy and living compassion, it's not about the self. The self begins to give away. One gets out of the way, ultimately. So the spirit of compassion can come through you. We all know that our obsessions with the self is a cultural disease. And to think that compassion is a self trait, how do you say, it can get it tangled up in the habits of narcissism and rather the self-accusations, "Oh God, I'm not compassionate enough. I am not compassionate enough. Fuck it." Forgive my French, as they say. Spider Woman, the old Hopi story, is that it was coming to be the winter solstice, as it is now, and the earth was getting very dark, and the old people, which is to say the animals, they were concerned that the light would not return. So they held counsel together, and then Bear threw out a rope and tried pulling in the sun, but he couldn't. And then Wolf tried throwing out a rope. He couldn't do it. And then Grandmother Spider, who I was singing in Navajo, Nache Edza, she said, "I can do it." And she threw out a little thread and pulled the sun in. Spider, there's so much one can say about Spider. I call her mi novia. I was married to her ritually. She is, in this context, the spirit of interconnection. She's also the spirit of craft. She was the spirit of the weavers, is the spirit of the weavers for the Navajo people. But she's the spirit of interconnection, and that little thread, pulling it in, you know. The little thread, for example, Art Patterson, just saying, "No, really." And me, getting it. This is a brother who had his brother killed. Forgive me, I didn't mention, my brother's skeleton was found. by a deer hunter 4 years after he disappeared. My mother and I gathered his remains. They checked out the DNA, and of course it was him. And I went with her to bury him. She opened up this plastic blue box, femur bone skull. Pelvis, and she lifted up his skull and she kissed it on his crown. Radical empathy. Radical empathy is my translation of Dekchim Nyamje, which in Tibetan means equalizing and exchanging self and other. Let me look at this gorgeous little article, the APR, the American Poetry Review. There's an article called The Practice by William Carlos Williams, who you know was an extraordinary poet, and he was also a medical doctor. And he believed that being a doctor and being a poet were two sides of the same coin. He learned to be a poet from his patients, and he learned to be a doctor from his patients. I was reading this, and I think this is radical empathy. I lost myself in the very properties of their minds. For the moment at least, I actually became them, whoever they should be. So that when I detached myself from them at the end of a half hour of intense concentration over some illness which was affecting them, it was as though I were reawakening from a sleep. For the moment I myself did not exist. Nothing of myself affected me. As a consequence, I came back to myself as from any other sleep, rested. This is when one comes towards radical empathy, there is a kind of, I want to say, aware, vividly aware self-forgetting, equalizing and exchanging self and other. I think about when I was a nurse once on the oncology floor at UCLA Medical Center, 10th floor, 16-hour shift, very, very, very busy. And the first, 8 hours, I was running around just doing this and that and the other thing. And I would pass by this patient's room, not my patient, and there was a boy, maybe 14 or 15 years old, Latino, standing in the hallway weeping. And I knew that I was so busy, there's no way I could tend to him at all. And he was, you know, when I was a kid, he had the profile of a pachuco. I don't know if you know what pachuco is, but he was the kind of kid that made my biracial childhood seriously miserable, you know? It's like, I had this, you know, unreflected, like, visceral, like, fear, which was, in fact, bullshit. But it was there, you know. A couple hours later, I'm at the nurse's station. Apparently, this kid had gone into the public bathroom, plugged up the sink with paper towels, and flooded it. And the ¿cómo se dice? The secretary had called security, and she said, just to scare him. Just to scare him. And I mobilized. I realized I was getting a little bit of the story from his nurse. His mother was dying of liver cancer in the room. She was really critical. I mean, she was going to die that night. She did die that night. His family was gathered around her bedside. Liver cancer, I mean, liver failure is it's a terrifying thing if you're not a nurse, or even if you are. You know, she was very much jaundiced, and she had a huge swollen belly from ascites, and she, of course, was completely unconscious, had been for a couple of days. And I knew I had to go in, and I did not know. I was scared. No longer scared of the pachuco, just scared like, what do I do here? So I walked in, and I spoke in my pochismo Spanish, you know, and I said, Armando, is it true that you plugged up the sink and flooded the bathroom? And he kind of looked at his feet, and he said, yes. And I said, is it true that you have so many feelings that you don't know what to do with them? And he said, that's true. And I said, well, you know, when I was a little older than you, my father died, and I know what it is to have so many feelings, and I acted out too. The secretary called security, and I'll send them away. It is true, you're not a bad person, and you won't do this again. And he said, I won't. And then I looked up at his family and said, take care of this boy. His heart is breaking. And I walked out the door just as security arrived. And I explained briefly my conversation. I said, leave him alone. His heart is breaking. And that was that. That is Nyakche, Dekshen Nyamje. That is radical empathy. I was that boy. It is, on one hand, there's the intimate moments where such a thing happens. And then there's the training, of course. I was a housewife. Taking care of my little daughter and reading feminist literature. Like any other housewife in 1975, you know? And then, of course, I did write my book on black people's dreams about white people, and my spiritual practice for several years was just the deconstructing of just garden variety white male arrogance, because I was writing, I had to look at these eyes, the thing about Dekshim Nyamje, radical empathy, it rhymes with the Cherokee proverb, we can only understand another's story until we've walked three moons in their moccasins. It's about seeing things through another's eyes. And that is the training. My training as a woman. My wife is not convinced. My current wife. And for me to do justice to the dreams I had gathered, I had to put the white Mexican boy to the side and look at them through another set of eyes. It was required. So that is radical empathy. And finally, we come to the mysterium. The mysterium is living compassion. What Glasser calls good Buddhist, that she is no self and no other. The mysterium, as I said earlier, this is the ultimate and radical paradigm shift. One does get out of the way so the spirit of compassion can come through unimpeded in its radiant brilliance. Again, at UCLA Medical Center, I had come back from Africa from my second initiation in Zimbabwe, and I was seriously jet-lagged. And there's always a... African time is not Los Angeles time, I can't tell you. I mean, not the clock difference, but folks move slower. There's no hurry to go anywhere. And I, you know, start my shift. At a crazy med-surg floor, busy, 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 busy. I drank 8 or 9 cups of coffee. I figured if I just have enough caffeine in my veins, I'll be able to meet all this, but no way. I'm just like, no way. And I felt like people were a bunch of drunken dervishes spinning around me here and there, and I was still moving in African time. So, you know, it was about 3 or 4 in the morning, and my shift was finally sort of beginning to slow down, sort of. I mean, I felt like I was on top of everything. And then the charge nurse says, I have an admit. It's like, okay. I breathed. I went up to the patient's door. And there's always the crossing of the threshold, you know, when one comes to the bedside of the ill. There's a threshold one must cross to be present and available. And I said, dear God, help me here. Make use of me, please. You know? I know this very sincere and hopeless quality of prayer. Because I can't do it. I can't. Here I am. So I go in, and this guy, Lewis, is a 52-year-old man with Down syndrome. Hugely hydrocephalic. Honest to God, I didn't even know people lived that long with Down syndrome. What do I know? But he was old from Down syndrome point of view. And his mother had taken him in because he had an abscess on his foot. It was infected. So he needed antibiotic therapy and such. And I admitted him. I got all my paperwork out. And I'm interviewing him and trying to gather whatever information he could relay to me, which was not necessarily coherent from... It wasn't somebody you had a complex dialogue with, to put it mildly. But he was telling me his father had died 3 or 4 months ago and his mother was old. And I knew that when his mother died, he'd probably be in an institution, I suspect, probably. And, of course, there was not even a hint of anything like self-pity. That was not in his neurological structure or something. And I got some Curlex and I changed his, I I bandaged his foot and whatever, cleaned it, and antibiotic cream, and hung an IV of antibiotics. And I said, you were a remarkable man. And he said, thank you. And I left. And he made me whole. He made me whole. I had been in a chaotic mind and simply this radiantly simple connection put me back together again. I realized that the activity of compassion is healing for the one who presumably is the compassionate one. But you know what? There's something here. Bless her soul. Where are you? My various notes. Zadie Smith. I wrote out down this juicy quote of hers, and it's probably nowhere to be had. Well, I will probably hopelessly paraphrase it since I can't find it. Zadie Smith said that when the self drops away and one realizes that compassion is a pure gift, expecting nothing whatsoever in return, and compassion suspends in the air between the so-called giver of it and the so-called receiver of it, that is living compassion. That's what happened between me and Lewis. Compassion was an environmental presence that he and I were bathed in. It was a light, and it did heal me. I mean, it put me together. I was a wreck of a human being before I met him, and I was able to leave his presence whole. So I have, I think, 4 minutes left, and I'm going to read a poem, and then I don't know what we do. We both get together and receive questions, or
read the poem.
What?
Read the poem.
I am. Oh, okay. Cut for the harvest.
They will be there.
What? What?
They will be there.
They will be there. Spoken like a true Buddhist, baby. Ambuya Boy Boy, the song I sang to Ambuya Boy Boy, that's Shona for Grandmother Spider. So this is called Cut for the Harvest for Ambuya Boy Boy and Mandaza Kandemwa. One. As I lie in bed, sleepless, raving, urinating on myself, body slowly unraveling, how is it that spirit plants medicine in the body through illness? Multiple sclerosis. What is it through illness utters wisdom, dares say the name of the God that reweaves the world? Two. Michael, it is time you sing of how your body has become medicine. I trust now only what is small and true, the soft touch of the hand, the sudden light of the eyes, the impulse of the gut towards compassion. Love is the only medicine I know. I know, and I know it is not mine. Pass swift from lover to beloved, weaving from hand to hand, a gift given, never owned, utterly ordinary, and also, perhaps, a song to those spirits knowing what healing is. healing, as I most certainly do not. 3. The lover sometimes feeds on suffering, and of that, the world is generous. Pray to that which has made my life common and kind, that changes not water to wine, but wine to water. For refusing the common fate, we become thieves in the night, too dark to ourselves to see, thief or blinded by light, staggering, unable to see blindness. 4. First, before the legs start giving away, before forgetting the English language, light sucked, eyes dim, can no longer discern the mind of my kin, wife beside me, twin 10,000 miles away. The body lost, stuttering, falling again and again, drooling, be shitting myself. Love is the only medicine I know, I have ever known. Love is the only medicine I have ever known. Love cut for the harvest. At last made real in my own defeat. And now time for a cookie. I will devour it.
Great. That's the best. She just want to lick your lips then.
Questions, thoughts?
Suppose, what is the source of the poem? If we'd like to share it with someone, is it, there's, where do we get it?
My mouth is full.
I'm sorry.
Well, it's on my website. I actually bought a whole bunch of nifty little business cards, so you can read it on my website.
You could tell people that you're the author
of it. Oh, you didn't know I was the author of it?
No.
Oh. Oh. Oh, I see. Inadvertently humble.
Is you.
I am the source. I was really hoping to print up a few of these, the Divine Comedy of Sacred Illness. These are the last two essays I wrote in the forest where I gave up multiple sclerosis. And this is a poem that's in it. The second essay, called The Divine Comedy of Sacred Illness, I had been alone for 6 weeks or something like that. And Spirit just whispered in my ear and said, Michael, you have to ask, what was the prayer the multiple sclerosis was an answer to? And so I drew 3 cards, tarot cards, and they were quite accurate and quite terrifying. And I said, dear God, give me the courage to answer these. And by 3 in the morning, I was laughing my ass off. And really, that week, I left behind multiple sclerosis. Oh, you.
So on a pragmatic basis, how about the website? I'm going to put it up
here. Oh,
so
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Just tell me and I'll put it up here.
Gathering In, with one N.
Well, that's probably a little G, isn't it? A little.
Yeah. little g as usual. Mundaz and I did a book called Gathering in the Names.
Gathering in.
Yeah. .com. And there are also several chapters from the book that I was teaching from, the Craft of Compassion, unpublished book, including there's an essay called The Heart of Learning the Craft of Compassion, from which I based this talk.
Any questions?
Thank you. Oh, bless you. Thank you so much.
Other questions, thoughts, comments, experiences?
Yeah, Dimitri.
I related to so much of what you said. A memory came back to me of when my father died. I had a terrible relationship with him. I mean, he was, you know, it was, anyhow, he died in Greece, and a Greek funeral was overwhelmingly emotional.
Of course.
And anyhow, when we buried him, the minute he was put in the ground, I felt this surge of love. And I thought it was finally my father was free to love me. That his spirit loved me. And what I didn't put together was my love for him.
Yeah.
And I did not ever have when he was alive. But it was so enormously, and that whole year afterwards, yeah, it was like amazing.
Thank you.
It took that, his death and his burial to be the catalyst. And so,
thank you.
You know, now I have fond memories of my father instead of the other day.
Yeah, hi. I'm in a 12-step program too. I'm supposed to make amends, and I've always had a really difficult relationship with my sister, and she's very, very toxic and angry. And I finally had to learn how to limit my time with her. Like, I went to New York recently, and I was there for 16 days, and I was going to visit her, and we worked it out at her request that I stay there 2.5 days. And, you know, I have friends who went like, I'm trying to stay a week, or I'm trying to stay 2 weeks. And I knew the perfect, you know, for her, my kindness was to stay there 2.5 days. So I stayed there, but then she was very angry downstairs at her husband. And I'm sitting there, we were going to the movies, and I'm the big sister. She's always been the little sister. And she was just really angry. I'm sitting in the car, and I'm saying, oh, you're so awful to myself. You're so toxic. And she's driving the car, we're going to the movies. And she's all chipper. She said, oh, it's like, you know, it's a Julia and Julia. And it's supposed to be such a great movie. And like, I really, all of a sudden it came to me, and I was just overcome with fear. I said, you know, she has absolutely no idea that I don't like her. And I was just, but I was just filled with, like, I was just filled with sadness, you know, and compassion for her. Because she just, you know, she was just chipper and happy. And she just doesn't know the effect she has. So it just really, you know, it really came to be that I, you know, I'm sitting there, the one filled with all this anger and hate. And she's sitting there, all chipper, and not realizing what was going on. So it was a real moment.
Thank you.
One of the things I was thinking about when Michael was talking about compassion and the importance of compassion for ourselves is this process of learning the to experience and be aware of this deep force of compassion when I'm in my most foolish human being self. And I was thinking about this when I was talking about it. Michael talked about compassion as being the nature of mind, or the natural mind is compassionate. Hmm. And of course, that's the similar bit in the Pure Land tradition, is that the underlying force of life is compassion. And I had an experience as I've been sort of working with this practice and listening and trying to do this deep hearing practice of the call, the name that calls, the compassion that exists in the universe for me and for everybody else. And I had started reading this book called The Book of Silence by Sarah Maitland. And I started reading it, and she begins talking about her early days growing up in her family, and an explication of how she traveled towards her interest in silence. Mm. And she's talking about her family, and then she's talking about growing up and then becoming an Oxford student and studying many traditions and philosophy and religious traditions. And you have to know this little background. I'm a high school dropout, and I don't have a high school degree, and I didn't get back to school for my bachelor's degree until after I had three children and I was divorced. And so I've always been sort of not only 10 years behind, but everything I wanted to learn, I had to do it while jockeying a lot of other things instead of just devoting my life for it. Well, I was reading this book, and I was getting a worse and worse mood. And I was getting more and more miserable. And I said, finally, I put the book up and went downstairs. This was my treat to myself on a Sunday, by the way. Was to read this book. And so I went downstairs. I was just miserable. I was angry, and I was unhappy, and I was trying to figure out, and I was thinking, oh, I have all this work to do for the Institute that needs to be done because I do a lot of the president's work on the weekend. And I'm not getting it done, and that's what's making me unhappy. If I would just stop reading the book and do the work I was supposed to, I'd be happier. But I sort of suspected that wasn't true, so I kept paying attention. I realized I was having an envy attack. I was just in this profound envy attack for this woman who was talking about how ungreat her life was with her family and how hard it was, and I was having this terrific envy attack for it, and I had made myself into a miserable wreck. And so I started saying the namutsu and trying to listen, just as I said it. And I would say, namu amida butsu, and I would listen. And I would say, namu amida butsu, and I would listen. And as I listened, what I became aware of was my own historical story. And I have to tell you, if I had not wanted to take the dogs away from the food, I would have introduced Michael. He and I are very long-term friends, and we became friends because we're both from a little town in New Mexico. And, well, of course, we didn't know that at the time. I first met him when he gave a talk here, and he announced that he was from this town. And I said, you've got to be the only other person in California who's from this same town. And both of us have lived our life as aspiring intellectuals. We wanted to be...
High school dropouts, aspiring intellectuals.
High school dropouts who wanted to be New York Manhattanites. And he's ever been the scholar I am because he's had the same passion for this. And so I was listening to this, and I suddenly had forgotten my own history. There wasn't a chance in anybody's book that I was going to end up at Oxford no matter what. I didn't have to get pregnant at 14. I didn't have to be a high school dropout. I still wasn't going to get up there. I became aware of what a miracle of gift it is and what compassion there was for me that I was led away from this little town in New Mexico through getting to be a high school dropout into a world in which I was taken in by people who had all kinds of interesting ideas that gradually led me to going back to school and getting a doctorate and being here today to do this work. And there was the force of compassion in my life that was working all the time underneath something that was my foolish human being, and my envy attack was
had no basis in reality because I could never have been this woman anyhow. I could have never had her opportunities. And so the envy just fell apart. And it sort of dissolved like we dissolved the meditation and disappeared. But what was left, it's not like it's so magical that, oh, now I'm saved by the Nambutsu. Of course, what was left was the longing. And instead of being in this horrible, miserable envy attack, I spent some time confronting my own longing for where she's come to in her life, and this point at which I had gotten in the book where she has gone into a 40-day and night retreat in a cabin up on the moors in the sky. She's a Brit. And she's gone for three reasons. She's gone to deepen her relationship with God, and she's gone to explore the nature of silence, and she's gone to deepen her own writing. She's an author of several books because she feels that something deeper wants to happen in her writing that can't happen as long as she's really over-involved and busy in the world. And the envy was replaced with an awareness or a longing of a time like that in my own life. And then maybe going to the craft of compassion for myself, which is a practice of saying, okay, how can I open up some opportunities for what I really want? And not spend my life wishing for what I couldn't have and didn't have. So that's a story that has to do with how the craft of compassion, if we're attentive to it, begins to work when we remember that of all sentient beings, we're here too. And that my compassion for myself is no different than my compassion for others because I am a foolish being among foolish beings. So I wanted to, that was sort of came up in my mind
when
you were talking about the importance of the very first step of compassion, which is to remember we're a sentient being too. And every bit is not only deserving of compassion as all the sentient beings, but that it starts inside of us. It's that from our own compassion for ourselves enables us to make the turning away from ourselves and the tending towards others. That it's my befriending of myself that allows me to befriend others.
What was the book again, Michelle?
It's called The Book of Silence by Sarah Maitland. And so that's one I think about the self-compassion. What else occurs to you as you think about what we said today and the notion of compassion? Befriending Dimitri?
If I may. Last January I had a stroke. And after the stroke, it was like a total transformation. There was something about that are confronted with your own mortality. Oh, I'm so close to death. I don't know where. I had this compassion. And I finally had compassion on myself. Like for everybody. It's like I've transformed. I'm not the same person I was before that stroke. And it's like discovering a whole new person. And so I look back and I think, that stroke was a gift. It was a gift. I mean, if that's what it took to get me to move on.
Yes.
So that compassion was overwhelming and still is.
I consider multiple sclerosis the great gift of my adult life. MS found me a spiritually ambitious bad combination. Aspiring messiah, actually. Grandiose, arrogant young man. You know? And it knocked me on my ass, which was a great humor for me because I'd always prayed that I'd have enough time to meditate, you know, and suddenly I was knocked on my ass. I had lots of time to meditate, that's for sure. And I'm working with a woman with MS now. She's in a wheelchair. And one of the questions I asked her, what is the gift that you received from MS that you could not have received any other way? And she said, the present moment. Yeah, it's like, that's a major gift. I mean, that's like, you know, as a Buddhist practitioner, that's not a small matter. And humility, as she said. And we had a common language, the two of us, around that. But thank you for sharing that, Dimitri. That's extraordinary. Yeah.
As Mike was talking about the gift that multiple sclerosis was to him, I have to tell you that as my friend, there were many times when I met him and he couldn't walk to the car by himself. We would meet to have coffee together. And I would never leave until I had seen him to his car because
it's happened.
So we would all be sort of shuffle down the street together, and I had some of the people in here know had a big experience that led to having to have a hip replacement. So we would laugh because I'd say, well, okay, we're supporting each other so that we don't fall off. Because we don't fall flat on the street. It's sort of like those potato races where we would put our bad sides together and then we would use our good sides to get us to his car.
Mm-hmm.
That others showed toward me when I was a child. Like, we used to go to the diner, and there were six kids, and the diner only served hamburgers or cheeseburgers, and I liked hot dogs. And my father would get up, and he'd cross the street, and he'd go like a mile down the other way to the only place that made hot dogs, and get the hot dog, and come all the way back, and come across the street, and go in the diner, and give me my hot dog. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that to me, I will remember that no matter what my father ever did for me in my whole life. That one thing is like, that's what made him a good father. And, you know, and I mean, that is the thing that makes me, like, help. Like, I saw a little child once walking with a thing of ketchup and he spilled it. Mm-hmm. And I immediately gave him the money and bought the ketchup. I knew he was going to get in trouble. And it's like, I couldn't not do it, you know. He's got to be doing all these little things for people because he did that for me.
Thank you. That's really critical what you're speaking of. There is a man, John or Jack McCransky, who's a he's a Vajrayana lama. He's a lama. He's in the Tibetan tradition, and he talks about one's benefactors, including the way you spoke to your father. He says the benefactors can be anybody. They can be the Buddha. They can be the person who's, you know, in the candy store when you're a kid. And he speaks of creating a refuge tree of one's benefactors. I mean, Michelle knows the practice better than I. I'm half trained in Vajrayana. But but to recognize that we have been sustained in small acts of kindness from the time we were a little child, and that is what comes through us for the sake of others.
Yeah. Mm. I just was going to bring up my love talk on MS. My mother had MS for many, many years. She's 90 years old and actually on hospice now. Not everybody walks through the door that is opened by the MS.
Yeah, hardly.
She spent all of her life, or much of her life, she had MS for 30 years.
Yeah.
On and off to remissions and then eventually getting much worse.
It's a fierce disease.
She never walked through that door. She fought it the whole way, and her world became smaller.
Mm.
The the best part of her life right now, frankly, is the morphine.
I really understand that. We just went through the death of my son-in-law's father, who went home to die with a diagnosis of liver cancer.
Yeah.
It was really very remarkable to be with him and see how grateful we all were for the morphine.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's the reason Michael and I are here today, and that's the part of this work, is because it's really hard to transform our minds. That I talk about it occurring in a thought moment, but there's many, many, many preparations for that thought moment to occur, so that there is a door to walk through, and even if we don't leave our disease and disorder behind, that we can walk through in a way that we can bear and endure our disease with love for ourselves and gratitude for those around us. And it's a work of a lifetime, really. In the tradition that I'm talking about today, the Pure Land tradition, there's an aspect of it is other power versus self-power, and Amitabha represents other power, and of course our small eager self represents self-power, but the idea is not that everything is done by other power. One of the analogies that's used is that the relationship between self-power and other power is like preparing a ship for sailing. Is that in order for the ship to sail, you have to build the ship, you have to supply the ship, you have to sew the sails, you have to set the sails, you have to be prepared to crew it, you have to do all the work to make sure that you can navigate it, and then you have to wait for the wind to fill the sails. Mm-hmm. And the wind that fills the sails, if we were going to talk about it from a Jungian perspective, of course, is the self. And in this notion from Pure Land Buddhism, Amitabha is the image of the personification that we can relate to, that is the force of compassion that fills the sails. But it isn't going to come about if we don't build a ship. Mm-hmm. And that's where self-power comes into play, mm-hmm. and is essential. And what makes it, I think, so important for us to come out and try and talk about this, and with every idea of imparting every little single bit of knowledge I know about the self-power part of it, so that something can open up, so can one thought moment has the possibility of happening when our winds fell with the wind that can sail. Anything else that people want to comment? We're just about going to take us through a loving kindness meditation, but I realized that we probably didn't have enough time for questions, so I can see if there's any other questions, and then I'm going to just give you a reflection to take home with you. Part of what the craft of compassion is taken from is related to something that in Buddhism is called the Four Immeasurables. Michael talked about sympathetic joy, compassion, rejoicing, and sorrowing for others, and coming to a sense of tranquility in it. One of the reasons Amitabha is seen in that pose of meditation, whenever you see that Buddha who has to meditate, either the hands cupped or the fingers cupped like this, that's Amitabha, is tranquility, really. And there's four steps to meditating on these aspects of compassion, and they are simply contained in four little sentences that we say first for ourselves, and that I'll say for anybody that we want to develop compassion for, be a friend, be an enemy, and then we say it for all the sentient beings in four lines on where may all beings be happy, and it happy causes happiness. May all beings of suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings know the joy that is endless and silence. May all beings have peace and equanimity.
yourself? May I be happy with my causes of happiness? May I be pleased? And we always do it for ourselves first. And the reason we always do it for ourselves first is because if we start with ourselves, then we're open to extending that to the other. And so then if you're dealing with a person who's difficult at work or in life or the relationship, or Montana, when she's nuts about food, part of what I was saying back there just to help her calm and sit with her was to say to her, Montana, will you be happy and have the causes of happiness? She finally has been able to settle down, even though she's a poodle that looks like a Labrador. But it can be anybody that you're having a problem with. And you find that if you do that, what will happen is something you need to relax about that person. You don't have to quit. You just have to say it. There's something about saying it. It's like smiling. There seems to be something biochemical about smiling. That if we turn up our lips, people's mood, there's been a lot of research on this, people's mood actually changes. And there's something about saying that words that has a calming effect on the feeling and the affect. And then, of course, we always end by extending it to all sentient beings, all sentient beings, all sentient beings. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and causes of suffering. May all sentient beings know the joy and the sorrow of sound. May all sentient beings be free of suffering. Thank you to all our hosts for coming. And Michael wants to make a little announcement while I'm writing this. Now, why don't you talk while I'm writing from behind you?
I shall. Little announcement. I do have my business card somewhere in your pocket or another, or maybe. Should any of you have a place that I might talk about the craft of compassion or do the weekend workshop, Craft of Compassion, let me know. I am doing the workshop in Santa Fe with Dr. Kirsten Gemeiner on the 20th of November, 20 and 21st, or 20, whatever, Saturday and Sunday. Saturday and Sunday, I'm going to be doing this talk on Thursday night in Santa Fe. You can go to my website. You can get all the particulars if you want. Also, if you would like me to speak, you have a church or whatever you might have, synagogue, temple, I'd be delighted to speak of this. The other thing is I am going back to Africa in early February, late January, early February. Me and Mandaza Kandemwa are going to initiate people in the Ngoma of the water spirit tradition. You can also read about that on my website. But I'm looking for folks if you are, you want to go to Africa. It's a remarkable thing for me because it's the first time I've been back to Africa since I've been healed of MS. And I never really ever thought I'd return to Africa because I couldn't really walk very well. So I think that's it. And in the bookstore, a couple of my books are there, including the Village of the Water Spirits, which is about black people's dreams about white people that Mandaza looked at from the angle of Bantu medicine tradition. It's not a psychological book. It's about the spirit life of African Americans.
Have I lost a dog? Yeah. I thought I had two wishes in my hand. I'm sorry, Michael, I just dropped over you.
That's fine. The other bookstore is Twin from Another Tribe, and it's the memoir of myself and Mandaza Kandemwa. We are regarded as twin brothers. And that's the whole story.